Kindly forget my existence, ladies and gentlemen, for a few minutes. He set to his supper and took no part in the conversation with which the table covered Lily's removal of the plates. The subject of talk was the opera company which was then at the Theatre Royal. Mr. Bartle Darcy, the tenor, a dark-complexioned young man with a smart moustache, praised very highly the leading contralto of the company, but Miss Furlong thought she had rather a vulgar style of production. Freddie Mallon said there was a Negro chieftain singing in the second part of the Gaiety pantomime who had one of the finest tenor voices he had ever heard. "Have you heard him?" he asked Mr. Bartle Darcy across the table. "No," answered Mr. Bartle Darcy carelessly. "Because," Freddie Mylands explained, "now I'd be curious to hear your opinion of him. I think he has a grand voice." "It takes Teddy to find out the really good things," said Mr. Brown familiarly to the table.
"And why couldn't he have a voice too?" asked Freddie Mylands sharply. "Is it because he's only a black?"
Nobody answered this question, and Mary Jane led the table back to the legitimate opera. One of her pupils had given her a pass for Mignon. Of course it was very fine, she said, but it made her think of poor Georgina Burns. Mr. Brown could go back further still to the old Italian companies that used to come to Dublin. Titchin's, Ilma de Murska, Campanini, the great Trebelli, Giulini, Ravelli, Aramburo.
"Those were the days," he said, "when there was something like singing to be heard in Dublin." He told, too, of how the top gallery of the old Royal used to be packed night after night, of how one night an Italian tenor had sung 5 encores to "Let Me Like a Soldier Fall," introducing a high C every time, and of how the gallery boys would sometimes, in their enthusiasm, unyoke the horses from the carriage of some great prima donna and pull her themselves through the streets to her hotel.
"Why did they never play the grand old operas now?" he asked. "Dinora, Lucrezia Borgia. Because they could not get the voices to sing them. That was why."
"Oh, well," said Mr. Bartle Darcy, "I presume there are as good singers today as there were then."
"Where are they?"
asked Mr. Brown defiantly.
"In London, Paris, Milan," said Mr. Bartle Darcy warmly. "I suppose Caruso, for example, is quite as good, if not better, than any of the men you have mentioned."
"Maybe so," said Mr. Brown, "but I may tell you I doubt it strongly."
"Oh, I'd give anything to hear Caruso sing," said Mary Jane.
"For me," said Aunt Kate, who had been picking a bone, "there was only one tenor, to please me, I mean. But I suppose none of you ever heard of him."
"Who was he, Miss Morkan?" asked Mr. Bartle Darcy politely.
"His name," said Aunt Kate, "was Parkinson. I heard him when he was in his prime, and I think he had then the purest tenor voice that was ever put into a man's throat."
"Strange," said Mr. Bartle Darcy. "I never even heard of him."
"Yes, yes, Miss Morkan is right," said Mr. Brown. "I remember hearing of old Parkinson, but he's too far back for me."
"A beautiful, pure, sweet, mellow English tenor," said Aunt Kate with enthusiasm.
Gabriel, having finished, the huge pudding was transferred to the table. The clatter of forks and spoons began again. Gabriel's wife served out spoonfuls of the pudding and passed the plates down the table. Midway down they were held up by Mary Jane, who replenished them with raspberry or orange jelly or with blancmange and jam. The pudding was of Aunt Julia's making, and she received praises for it from all quarters. She herself said that it was not quite brown enough.
"Well, I hope, Miss Morkan," said Mr. Brown, "that I'm brown enough for you, because, you know, I'm all brown."
All the gentlemen, except Gabriel, ate some of the pudding out of compliment to Aunt Julia. As Gabriel never ate sweets, the celery had been left for him. Freddie Mallins also took a stalk of celery and ate it with his pudding. He had been told that celery was the capital thing for the blood, and he was just then under doctor's care. Mrs. Mallins, who had been silent all through the supper, said that her son was going down to Mount Melleray in a week or so. The table then spoke of Mount Melleray, how bracing the air was down there, how hospitable the monks were, and how they never asked for a penny piece from their guests.
"And do you mean to say," asked Mr. Brown incredulously, "that a chap can go down there and put up there as if it were a hotel and live on the fat of the land, and then come away without paying a farthing?"
"Oh, most people give some donation to the monastery when they leave," said Mary Jane.
I wish we had an institution like that in our church, said Mr. Brown, candidly.
He was astonished to hear that the monks never spoke, got up at 2 in the morning, and slept in their coffins. He asked what they did it for. That's the rule of the order, said Aunt Kate firmly.
Yes, but why? Asked Mr. Brown.
Aunt Kate repeated that it was the rule, that was all. Mr. Brown still seemed not to understand. Freddy Malins explained to him, as best he could, that the monks were trying to make up for the sins committed by all the sinners in the outside world. The explanation was not very clear, for Mr. Brown grinned and said,
I like that idea very much, but wouldn't a comfortable spring bed do them as well as a coffin?
The coffin, said Mary Jane, is to remind them of their last end. As the subject had grown lugubrious, it was buried in a silence of the table, during which Mrs. Malins could be heard saying to her neighbour, in an indistinct undertone, They are very good men, the monks, very pious men. The raisins and almonds and figs and apples and oranges and chocolates and sweets were now passed about the table, and Aunt Julia invited all the guests to have either port or sherry. At first Mr. Bartle D'Arcy refused to take either, but one of his neighbours nudged him and whispered something to him, upon which he allowed his glass to be filled. Gradually, as the last glasses were being filled, the conversation ceased. A pause followed, broken only by the noise of the wine and by unsettlings of chairs. The Misses Morkan, all three, looked down at the tablecloth. Someone coughed once or twice, and then a few gentlemen patted the table gently as a signal for silence. The silence came, and Gabriel pushed back his chair and stood up. The patting at once grew louder in encouragement, and then ceased altogether. Gabriel leaned his 10 trembling fingers on the tablecloth and smiled nervously at the company. Meeting a row of upturned faces, he raised his eyes to the chandelier. The piano was playing a waltz tune, and he could hear the skirts sweeping against the drawing-room door. People, perhaps, were standing in the snow on the quay outside, gazing up at the lighted windows and listening to the waltz music. The air was pure there. In the distance lay the park, where the trees were weighted with snow. The Wellington Monument wore a gleaming cap of snow that flashed westward over the white field of 15 acres. He began. Ladies and gentlemen, it has fallen to my lot this evening, as in years past, to perform a very pleasing task, but a task for which I am afraid my poor powers as a speaker are all too inadequate.
No, no,
said Mr. Brown, but however that may be, I can only ask you tonight to take the will for the deed and to lend me your attention for a few moments while I endeavour to express to you in words what my feelings are on this occasion. Ladies and gentlemen, it is not the first time that we have gathered together under this hospitable roof, around this hospitable board. It is not the first time that we have been the recipients, or perhaps I had better say, the victims, of the hospitality of certain good ladies. He made a circle in the air with his arm and paused. Everyone laughed or smiled at Aunt Kate and Aunt Julia and Mary Jane, who all turned crimson with pleasure. Gabriel went on more boldly. I feel more strongly with every recurring year that our country has no tradition which does it so much honour and which it should guard so jealously as that of its hospitality. It is a tradition that is unique as far as my experience goes, and I have visited not a few places abroad among the modern nations. Some would say, perhaps, that with us it is rather a failing than anything to be boasted of, but granted even that, it is to my mind a princely failing, and one that I trust will long be cultivated among us. Of one thing, at least, I am sure. As long as this one roof shelters the good ladies aforesaid, and I wish from my heart it may do so for many and many a long year to come, the tradition of genuine, warm-hearted, courteous Irish hospitality, which our forefathers have handed down to us and which we, in turn, must hand down to our descendants, is still alive among us. A hearty murmur of assent ran round the table. It shot through Gabriel's mind that Miss Ivers was not there, and that she had gone away discourteously, and he said with confidence in himself, "Ladies and gentlemen, a new generation is growing up in our midst, a generation actuated by new ideas and new principles. It is serious and enthusiastic for these new ideas, and its enthusiasm, even when it is misdirected, is, I believe, in the main sincere. But we are living in a sceptical and, if I may use the phrase, a thought-tormented age. And sometimes I fear that this new generation, educated or hyper-educated as it is, will lack those qualities of humanity, of hospitality, of kindly humour, which belonged to an older day. Listening tonight to the names of all those great singers of the past, it seemed to me, I must confess, that we were living in a less spacious age. Those days might, without exaggeration, be called spacious days, and if they are gone beyond recall, let us hope at least that in gatherings such as this we shall still speak of them with pride and affection, still cherish in our hearts the memory of those dead and gone great ones, whose fame the world will not willingly let die."
"Hear, hear," said Mr. Brown loudly.
"But yet," continued Gabriel, his voice falling into a softer inflection, "there are always in gatherings such as this sadder thoughts that will recur to our minds, thoughts of the past, of youth, of changes, of absent faces that we miss here tonight. Our path through life is strewn with many such sad memories, and were we to brood upon them always, we could not find the heart to go on bravely with our work among the living. We have all of us living duties and living affections which claim, and rightly claim, our strenuous endeavours. Therefore, I will not linger on the past. I will not let any gloomy moralising intrude upon us here tonight. Here we are gathered together for a brief moment from the bustle and rush of our everyday routine. We are met here as friends, in the spirit of good fellowship, as colleagues, also to a certain extent, in the true spirit of camaraderie, and as the guests of, what shall I call them, the three graces of the Dublin musical world." The table burst into applause and laughter at this sally. Aunt Julia vainly asked each of her neighbours in turn to tell her what Gabriel had said. "He says we are the three graces, Aunt Julia," said Mary Jane. Aunt Julia did not understand, but she looked up, smiling, at Gabriel, who continued in the same vein. "Ladies and gentlemen, I will not attempt to play tonight the part that Paris played on another occasion. I will not attempt to choose between them. The task would be an invidious one, and one beyond my poor powers. For when I view them in turn, whether it be our chief hostess herself, whose good heart, whose too good heart has become a byword with all who know her, or her sister, who seems to be gifted with perennial youth, and whose singing must have been a surprise and a revelation to us all tonight, or, last but not least, when I consider our youngest hostess, talented, cheerful, hard-working, and the best of nieces, I confess, ladies and gentlemen, that I do not know to which of them I should award the prize." Gabriel glanced down at his aunts, and seeing the large smile on Aunt Julia's face and the tears which had risen to Aunt Kate's eyes, hastened to his close. He raised his glass of port gallantly, while every member of the company fingered a glass expectantly, and said loudly, "Let us toast them all three together. Let us drink to their health, wealth, long life, happiness and prosperity, and may they long continue to hold the proud and self-won position which they hold in their profession, and the position of honour and affection which they hold in our hearts." All the guests stood up, glass in hand, and turning towards The three seated ladies sang in unison, with Mr. Brown as leader, "For they are jolly gay fellows, for they are jolly gay fellows, for they are jolly gay fellows, which nobody can deny." Aunt Kate was making frank use of her handkerchief, and even Aunt Julia seemed moved. Freddie Malins beat time with his pudding fork, and the singers turned towards one another, as if in melodious conference, while they sang with emphasis, "Unless he tells a lie, unless he tells a lie." Then turning once more towards their hostesses, they sang, "For they are jolly gay fellows, for they are jolly gay fellows, for they are jolly gay fellows, which nobody can deny." The acclamation which followed was taken up beyond the door of the supper room by many of the other guests, and renewed time after time, Freddie Malins acting as officer with his fork on high. The piercing morning air came into the hall where they were standing so that Aunt Kate said, "Close the door, somebody. Mrs. Malins will get her death of cold." "Brown is out there, Aunt Kate," said Mary Jane.
"Brown is everywhere," said Aunt Kate, lowering her voice. Mary Jane laughed at her tone.
"Really," she said archly, "he is very attentive." "He's been laid on here like the gas," said Aunt Kate in the same tone, "all during the Christmas." She laughed herself this time, good-humouredly, and then added quickly, "But tell him to come in, Mary Jane, and close the door. I hope to goodness he didn't hear me." At that moment the hall door was opened, and Mr. Brown came in from the doorstep laughing, as if his heart would break. He was dressed in a long green overcoat with mock astrakhan cuffs and collar, and wore on his head an oval fur cap. He pointed down the snow-covered quay from where the sound of shrill, prolonged whistling was borne in.
"Teddy will have all the cabs in Dublin out," he said.
Gabriel advanced from the little pantry behind the office, struggling into his overcoat, and looking round the hall, said,
"Greta not down yet?"
"She's getting on her things, Gabriel," said Aunt Kate.
"Who's playing up there?"
asked Gabriel.
"Nobody. They're all gone."
"Oh, no, Aunt Kate," said Mary Jane. "Bartle D'Arcy and Miss O'Callaghan aren't gone yet."
"Someone is strumming at the piano, anyhow," said Gabriel.
Mary Jane glanced at Gabriel and Mr. Brown and said with a shiver, "It makes me feel cold to look at you two gentlemen muffled up like that. I wouldn't like to face your journey home at this hour."
"I'd like nothing better this minute," said Mr. Brown stoutly, "than a rattling fine walk in the country, or a fast drive with a good spanking goer between the shafts."
"We used to have a very good horse and trap at home," said Aunt Julia sadly.
"The never-to-be-forgotten Johnny," said Mary Jane, laughing. Aunt Kate and Gabriel laughed too.
"Why, what was wonderful about Johnny?" asked Mr. Brown.
"The late lamented Patrick Morcan, our grandfather, that is," explained Gabriel, "commonly known in his later years as the old gentleman, was a glue boiler."
"Oh, now, Gabriel," said Aunt Kate, laughing. "He had a starch mill."
"Well, glue or starch," said Gabriel. "The old gentleman had a horse by the name of Johnny, and Johnny used to work in the old gentleman's mill, walking round and round in order to drive the mill. That was all very well, but now comes the tragic part about Johnny. One fine day the old gentleman thought he'd like to drive out with the quality to a military review in the park."
"The Lord have mercy on his soul," said Aunt Kate compassionately.
"Amen," said Gabriel.
"So the old gentleman, as I said, harnessed Johnny and put on his very best tall hat and his very best stock collar and drove out in grand style from his ancestral mansion somewhere near Back Lane, I think."
Everyone laughed, even Mrs. Malins, at Gabriel's manner, and Aunt Kay said,
"Oh, no, Gabriel, he didn't live in Back Lane, really. Only the mill was there."
"Out from the mansion of his forefathers," continued Gabriel, "he drove with Johnny, and everything went on beautifully until Johnny came in sight of King Billy's statue. And whether he fell in love with the horse King Billy sits on, or whether he thought he was back again in the mill, anyhow, he began to walk around the statue." Gabriel paced in a circle round the hall in his galoshes amid the laughter of the others.
"Round and round he went," said Gabriel.
"And the old gentleman, who was a very pompous old gentleman, was highly indignant." "Go on, sir! What do you mean, sir? Johnny?
Johnny, most extraordinary conduct. Can't understand the horse.
The peals of laughter which followed Gabriel's imitation of the incident were interrupted by a resounding knock at the hall door. Mary Jane ran to open it and let in Freddy Mullins. Freddy Mullins, with his hat well back on his head and his shoulders humped with cold, was puffing and steaming after his exertions.
"I could only get one cab," he said.
"Oh, we'll find another along the quay," said Gabriel. "Yes," said Aunt Kate. "Better not keep Mrs. Mullins standing in the draught."
Mrs. Mullins was helped down the front steps by her son and Mr. Brown, and after many manoeuvres hoisted into the cab. Freddy Mullins clambered in after her and spent a long time settling her on the seat, Mr. Brown helping him with advice. At last she was settled comfortably, and Freddy Mullins invited Mr. Brown into the cab. There was a good deal of confused talk, and then Mr. Brown got into the cab. The cabman settled his rug over his knees and bent down for the address. The confusion grew greater, and the cabman was directed differently by Freddy Mullins and Mr. Brown, each of whom had his head out through a window of the cab. The difficulty was to know where to drop Mr. Brown along the route, and Aunt Kate, Aunt Julia, and Mary Jane helped the discussion from the doorstep with cross-directions and contradictions and abundance of laughter. As for Freddy Mullins, he was speechless with laughter. He popped his head in and out of the window every moment to the great danger of his hat, and told his mother how the discussion was progressing, till at last Mr. Brown shouted to the bewildered cabman above the din of everybody's laughter,
"Do you know Trinity College?"
"Yes, sir," said the cabman.
"Well, drive bang up against Trinity College gates," said Mr. Brown, "and then we'll tell you where to go. You understand now?"
"Yes, sir," said the cabman.
"Make like a bird for Trinity College."
"Right, sir," cried the cabman.
The horse was whipped up, and the cab rattled off along the quay amid a chorus of laughter and adieus. Gabriel had not gone to the door with the others. He was in a dark part of the hall, gazing up the staircase. A woman was standing near the top of the first flight, in the shadow also. He could not see her face, but he could see the terracotta and salmon-pink panels of her skirt, which the shadow made appear black and white. It was his wife. She was leaning on the banisters, listening to something. Gabriel was surprised at her stillness, and strained his ear to listen also. But he could hear little save the noise of laughter and dispute on the front steps, a few chords struck on the piano, and a few notes of a man's voice singing. He stood still in the gloom of the hall, trying to catch the air that the voice was singing, and gazing up at his wife. There was grace and mystery in her attitude, as if she were a symbol of something. He asked himself, what is a woman standing on the stairs in the shadow, listening to distant music, a symbol of? If he were a painter, he would paint her in that attitude. Her blue felt hat would show off the bronze of her hair against the darkness, and the dark panels of her skirt would show off the light ones. Distant music, he would call the picture if he were a painter. The hall door was closed, and Aunt Kate, Aunt Julia, and Mary Jane came down the hall, still laughing.
"Well, isn't Freddy terrible?" said Mary Jane. "He's really terrible."
Gabriel said nothing, but pointed up the stairs towards where his wife was standing. Now that the hall door was closed, the voice and the piano could be heard more clearly. Gabriel held up his hand for them to be silent. The song seemed to be in the old Irish tonality, and the singer seemed uncertain both of his words and of his voice. The voice, made plaintive by distance and by the singer's hoarseness, faintly illuminated the cadence of the air with words expressing grief. "Oh, the rain falls on my heavy locks, and the dew wets my skin. My babe lies cold."
"Oh," exclaimed Mary Jane. "It's Bartle Darcy singing, and he wouldn't sing all the night. Oh, I'll get him to sing a song before he goes." "Oh, do, Mary Jane," said Aunt Kate.
Mary Jane brushed past the others and ran to the staircase, but before she reached it the singing stopped, and the piano was closed abruptly.
"Oh, what a pity," she cried. "Is he coming down, Greta?"
Gabriel heard his wife answer yes, and saw her come down towards them. A few steps behind her were Mr. Bartle Darcy and Miss O'Callaghan. "Oh, Mr. Darcy," cried Mary Jane, "it's downright mean of you to break off like that when we were all in raptures listening to you."
"I have been at him all the evening," said Miss O'Callaghan, "and Mrs. Conroy too, and he told us he had a dreadful cold and couldn't sing."
"Oh, Mr. Darcy," said Aunt Kate, "now that was a great fib to tell."
"Can't you see that I'm as hoarse as a crow?" said Mr. Darcy roughly.
He went into the pantry hastily and put on his overcoat. The others, taken aback by his rude speech, could find nothing to say. Aunt Kate wrinkled her brows and made signs to the others to drop the subject. Mr. Darcy stood swathing his neck carefully and frowning.
"It's the weather," said Aunt Julia, after a pause. "Yes, everybody has colds," said Aunt Kate readily. "Everybody."
"They say," said Mary Jane, "we haven't had snow like it for 30 years, and I read this morning in the newspaper that the snow is general all over Ireland."
"I love the look of snow," said Aunt Julia, sadly.
"So do I," said Miss O'Callaghan. "I think Christmas is never really Christmas unless we have the snow on the ground."
"But poor Mr. Darcy doesn't like the snow," said Aunt Kate, smiling.
Mr. Darcy came from the pantry, fully swathed and buttoned, and in a repentant tone told them the history of his cold. Everyone gave him advice and said it was a great pity and urged him to be very careful of his throat in the night air. Gabriel watched his wife, who did not join in the conversation. She was standing right under the dusty fanlight, and the flame of the gas lit up the rich bronze of her hair, which he had seen her drying at the fire a few days before. She was in the same attitude and seemed unaware of the talk about her. At last she turned towards them, and Gabriel saw that there was colour on her cheeks and that her eyes were shining. A sudden tide of joy went leaping out of his heart. "Mr. Darcy," she said, "what is the name of that song you were singing?"
"It's called The Lass of Ochram," said Mr. Darcy, "but I couldn't remember it properly. Why, do you know it?"
"The Lass of Ochram," she repeated. "I couldn't think of the name." "It's a very nice air," said Mary Jane. "I'm sorry we're not in voice tonight."
"Now, Mary Jane," said Aunt Kate, "don't annoy Mr. Darcy. Don't have him annoyed."
Seeing that all were ready to start, she shepherded them to the door, where good night was said.
"Well, good night, Aunt Kate, and thanks for the pleasant evening."
"Good night, Gabriel. Good night, Greta."
"Good night, Aunt Kate, and thanks ever so much. Good night, Aunt Julia."
"Oh, good night, Greta. I didn't see you."
"Good night, Mr. Darcy. Good night, Miss O'Callaghan. Good night, Miss Morkan. Good night again. Good night, all. Safe home. Good night. Good night." The morning was still dark. A dull yellow light brooded over the houses and the river, and the sky seemed to be descending. It was slushy underfoot, and only streaks and patches of snow lay on the roofs, on the parapets of the quay, and on the area railings. The lamps were still burning redly in the murky air, and across the river the Palace of the Four Courts stood out menacingly against the heavy sky. She was walking on before him with Mr. Bartle Darcy, her shoes in a brown parcel tucked under one arm, and her hands holding her skirt up from the slush. She had no longer any grace of attitude, but Gabriel's eyes were still bright with happiness. The blood went bounding along his veins, and the thoughts went rioting through his brain, proud, joyful, tender, valorous. She was walking on before him so lightly and so erect that he longed to run after her, noiselessly, catch her by the shoulders, and say something foolish and affectionate into her ear. She seemed to him so frail that he longed to defend her against something and then to be alone with her. Moments of their secret life together burst like stars upon his memory. A heliotrope envelope was lying beside his breakfast cup, and he was caressing it with his hand. Birds were twittering in the ivy, and the sunny web of the curtain was shimmering along the floor. He could not eat for happiness. They were standing on the crowded platform, and he was placing a ticket inside the warm palm of her glove. He was standing with her in the cold, looking in through a grated window at a man making bottles in a roaring furnace. It was very cold. Her face, fragrant in the cold air, was quite close to his. And suddenly she called out to the man at the furnace, "Is the fire hot, sir?" But the man could not hear her with the noise of the furnace. It was just as well. He might have answered rudely. A wave of yet more tender joy escaped from his heart and went coursing in warm flood along his arteries. Like the tender fires of stars, moments of their life together, that no one knew of or would ever know of, broke upon and illumined his memory. He longed to recall to her those moments, to make her forget the years of their dull existence together, and remember only their moments of ecstasy. For the years, he felt, had not quenched his soul, or hers, their children, his writing, her household cares had not quenched all their soul's tender fire. In one letter that he had written to her then, he had said, "Why is it that words like these seem to me so dull and cold? Is it because there is no word tender enough to be your name?" Like distant music, these words that he had written years before were borne towards him from the past. He longed to be alone with her, when the others had gone away, when he and she were in their room in the hotel. Then they would be alone together. He would call her softly. "Greta." Perhaps she would not hear at once. She would be undressing. Then something in his voice would strike her. She would turn and look at him. At the corner of Wine Tavern Street, they met a cab. He was glad of its rattling noise as it saved him from conversation. She was looking out of the window and seemed tired. The others spoke only a few words, pointing out some building or street. The horse galloped along wearily under the murky morning sky, dragging his old rattling box after his heels. And Gabriel was again in a cab with her, galloping to catch the boat, galloping to their honeymoon. As the cab drove across O'Connell Bridge, Miss O'Callaghan said, "They say you never cross O'Connell Bridge without seeing a white horse."
"I see a white man this time," said Gabriel.
"Where?"
asked Mr. Bartle Darcy. Gabriel pointed to the statue, on which lay patches of snow. Then he nodded familiarly to it and waved his hand.
"Good night, Dan,"
he said gaily.
When the cab drew up before the hotel, Gabriel jumped out, and, in spite of Mr. Bartle Darcy's protest, paid the driver. He gave the man a shilling over his fare. The man saluted and said, "A prosperous new year to you, sir."
"The same to you," said Gabriel cordially.
She leaned for a moment on his arm in getting out of the cab, and while standing at the curbstone, bidding the others good night, she leaned lightly on his arm, as lightly as when she had danced with him a few hours before. He had felt proud and happy then, happy that she was his, proud of her grace and wifely carriage. But now, after the kindling again of so many memories, the first touch of her body, musical and strange and perfumed, sent through him a keen pang of lust. Under cover of her silence, he pressed her arm closely to his side, and as they stood at the hotel door, he felt that they had escaped from their lives and duties, escaped from home and friends, and run away together with wild and radiant hearts to a new adventure. An old man was dozing in a great hooded chair in the hall. He lit a candle in the office and went before them to the stairs. They followed him in silence, their feet falling in soft thuds on the thickly carpeted stairs. She mounted the stairs behind the porter, her head bowed in the ascent, her frail shoulders curved as with a burden, her skirt girt tightly about her. He could have flung his arms about her hips and held her still, for his arms were trembling with desire to seize her, and only the stress of his nails against the palms of his hands held the wild impulse of his body in check. The porter halted on the stairs to settle his guttering candle. They halted too on the steps below him.
In the silence, Gabriel could hear the falling of the molten wax into the tray and the thumping of his own heart against his ribs. The porter led them along a corridor and opened a door. Then he set his unstable candle down on a toilet table and asked at what hour they were to be called in the morning. 8, said Gabriel. The porter pointed to the tap of the electric light and began a muttered apology, but Gabriel cut him short. We don't want any light. We have light enough from the street. And I say, he added, pointing to the candle, you might remove that handsome article like a good man. The porter took up his candle again, but slowly, for he was surprised by such a novel idea. Then he mumbled good night and went out. Gabriel shot the lock to. A ghostly light from the street lamp lay in a long shaft from one window to the door. Gabriel threw his overcoat and hat on a couch and crossed the room towards the window. He looked down into the street in order that his emotion might calm a little. Then he turned and leaned against a chest of drawers with his back to the light. She had taken off her hat and cloak and was standing before a large swinging mirror, unhooking her waist. Gabriel paused for a few moments, watching her, and then said, Greta. She turned away from the mirror slowly and walked along the shaft of light towards him. Her face looked so serious and weary that the words would not pass Gabriel's lips. No, it was not the moment yet. You looked tired, he said. I am a little, she answered. You don't feel ill or weak? No, tired, that's all. She went on to the window and stood there, looking out. Gabriel waited again, and then, fearing that diffidence was about to conquer him, he said, abruptly, By the way, Greta, what is it? You know that poor fellow Malins, he said quickly. Yes, what about him? Well, poor fellow, he's a decent sort of chap after all, continued Gabriel in a false voice. He gave me back that sovereign I lent him, and I didn't expect it, really. It's a pity he wouldn't keep away from that Brown, because he's not a bad fellow at heart. He was trembling now with annoyance. Why did she seem so abstracted? He did not know how he could begin. Was she annoyed, too, about something? If she would only turn to him, or come to him of her own accord. To take her, as she was, would be brutal. No, he must see some ardour in her eyes first. He longed to be master of her strange mood. When did you lend him the pound? She asked, after a pause. Gabriel strove to restrain himself from breaking out into brutal language about the sottish Malins and his pound. He longed to cry to her from his soul, to crush her body against his, to overmaster her. But he said, Oh, at Christmas, when he opened that little Christmas card shop in Henry Street. He was in such a fever of rage and desire that he did not hear her come from the window. She stood before him for an instant, looking at him strangely, then suddenly raising herself on tiptoe and resting her hands lightly on his shoulders. She kissed him. You are a very generous person, Gabriel, she said. Gabriel, trembling with delight at her sudden kiss and at the quaintness of her phrase, put his hands on her hair and began smoothing it back, scarcely touching it with his fingers. The washing had made it fine and brilliant. His heart was brimming over with happiness. Just when he was wishing for it, she had come to him of her own accord. Perhaps her thoughts had been running with his. Perhaps she had felt the impetuous desire that was in him, and then the yielding mood had come upon her. Now that she had fallen to him so easily, he wondered why he had been so diffident. He stood, holding her head between his hands. Then, slipping one arm swiftly about her body and drawing her towards him, he said softly, "Greta, dear, what are you thinking about?" She did not answer nor yield wholly to his arm. He said again softly, "Tell me what it is, Greta. I think I know what is the matter. Do I know?" She did not answer at once. Then she said in an outburst of tears, "Oh, I'm thinking about that song, The Lass of the Achram." She broke loose from him and ran to the bed, and throwing her arms across the bed rail, hid her face. Gabriel stood stock still for a moment in astonishment and then followed her. As he passed in the way of the cheval glass, he caught sight of himself in full length, his broad, well-filled shirt front, the face whose expression always puzzled him when he saw it in a mirror, and his glimmering, gilt-rimmed eyeglasses. He halted a few paces from her and said, "What about the song? Why does that make you cry?" She raised her head from her arms and dried her eyes with the back of her hand like a child. A kinder note than he had intended went into his voice. "Why, Greta?" he asked. "I'm thinking about a person long ago who used to sing that song." "And who was the person long ago?" asked Gabriel, smiling. "It was the person I used to know in Galway when I was living with my grandmother," she said. A smile passed away from Gabriel's face. A dull anger began to gather again at the back of his mind, and the dull fires of his lust began to grow angrily in his veins. "Someone you were in love with?" he asked, ironically. "It was a young boy I used to know," she answered, "named Michael Fury. He used to sing that song, The Lass of Outram. He was very delicate." Gabriel was silent. He did not wish her to think that he was interested in this delicate boy. "I can see him so plainly," she said after a moment. "Such eyes as he had. Big dark eyes, and such an expression in them. An expression."
"Oh, then you were in love with him," said Gabriel.
"I used to go out walking with him," she said, "when I was in Galway." A thought flew across Gabriel's mind.
"Perhaps that was why you wanted to go to Galway with that Ivers girl," he said coldly.
She looked at him and asked in surprise, "What for?" Her eyes made Gabriel feel awkward. He shrugged his shoulders and said,
"Well, how do I know? To see him, perhaps."
She looked away from him along the shaft of light towards the window in silence. "He's dead," she said at length. "He died when he was only 17. Isn't it a terrible thing to die so young as that?"
"What was he?"
asked Gabriel, still ironically. "He was in the gasworks," she said. Gabriel felt humiliated by the failure of his irony, and by the evocation of this figure from the dead, a boy in the gasworks. While he had been full of memories of their secret life together, full of tenderness and joy and desire, she had been comparing him in her mind with another. A shameful consciousness of his own person assailed him. He saw himself as a ludicrous figure, acting as a penny boy for his aunts, a nervous, well-meaning, sentimentalist, orating to vulgarians and idealizing his own clownish lusts, the pitiable, fatuous fellow he had caught a glimpse of in the mirror. Instinctively, he turned his back more to the light, lest you might see the shame that burned upon his forehead. He tried to keep up his tone of cold interrogation, but his voice when he spoke was humble and indifferent. "I suppose you were in love with this Michael Fury, Greta," he said. "I was great with him at that time," she said. Her voice was veiled and sad. Gabriel, feeling now how vain it would be to try to lead her whither he had purposed, caressed one of her hands and said, also sadly, "And what did he die of so young, Greta? Consumption, was it?"
"I think he died for me," she answered.
A vague terror seized Gabriel at this answer, as if at that hour when he had hoped to triumph, some impalpable and vindictive being was coming against him, gathering forces against him in its vague world. But he shook himself free of it with an effort of reason and continued to caress her hand. He did not question her again, for he felt that she would tell him of herself. Her hand was warm and moist. It did not respond to his touch, but he continued to caress it just as he had caressed her first letter to him that spring morning. "It was in the winter," she said. "About the beginning of the winter, when I was going to leave my grandmother's and come up here to the convent. And he was ill at the time in his lodgings in Galway and wouldn't be let out, and his people in Uachtaráid were written to. He was in decline, they said, or something like that. I never knew rightly." She paused for a moment and sighed. "Poor fellow," she said. "He was very fond of me, and he was such a gentle boy. We used to go out together, walking, you know, Gabriel, like the way they do in the country. He was going to study singing, only for his health. He had a very good voice. Poor Michael Fury."
"Well, and then?" asked Gabriel.
"And then, when it came to the time for me to leave Galway and come up to the convent, he was much worse, and I wouldn't be let see him. So I wrote a letter saying I was going up to Dublin and would be back in the summer and hoping he would be better then." She paused for a moment to get her voice under control and then went on. "Then the night before I left, I was in my grandmother's house in Nuns Island packing up. And I heard gravel thrown up against the window. The window was so wet I couldn't see, so I ran downstairs as I was and slipped out the back into the garden, and there was the poor fellow at the end of the garden, shivering."
"And did you not tell him to go back?"
asked Gabriel. "I implored of him to go home at once and told him he would get his death in the rain, but he said he did not want to live. I can see his eyes as well. He was standing at the end of the wall where there was a tree."
"And did he go home?"
asked Gabriel. "Yes, he went home. And when I was only a week in the convent, he died. And he was buried in Uachtaráid, where his people came from. Oh, the day I heard that he was dead." She stopped, choking with sobs, and overcome by emotion, flung herself face downward on the bed, sobbing in the quilt. Gabriel held her hand for a moment longer, irresolutely, and then, shy of intruding on her grief, let it fall gently and walked quietly to the window. She was fast asleep. Gabriel, leaning on his elbow, looked for a few moments unresentfully on her tangled hair and half-open mouth, listening to her deep-drawn breath. So she had had that romance in her life. A man had died for her sake. It hardly pained him now to think how poor a part he, her husband, had played in her life. He watched her while she slept, as though he and she had never lived together as man and wife. His curious eyes rested long upon her face and on her hair, and as he thought of what she must have been then, in that time of her first girlish beauty, a strange friendly pity for her entered his soul. He did not like to say even to himself that her face was no longer beautiful. But he knew that it was no longer the face for which Michael Fury had braved death. Perhaps she had not told him all the story. His eyes moved to the chair over which she had thrown some of her clothes. A petticoat string dangled to the floor. One boot stood upright, its limp upper fallen down. The fellow of it lay upon its side. He wondered at his riot of emotions of an hour before. From what had it proceeded? From his aunt's supper? From his own foolish speech? From the wine and dancing, the merrymaking when saying good night in the hall? The pleasure of the walk along the river in the snow. Poor Aunt Julia. She, too, would soon be a shade, with the shade of Patrick Morcan and his horse. He had caught that haggard look upon her face for a moment when she was singing Arrayed for the Bridal. Soon, perhaps, he would be sitting in that same drawing room, dressed in black, his silk hat on his knees. The blinds would be drawn down, and Aunt Kate would be sitting beside him, crying and blowing her nose, and telling him how Julia had died. He would cast about in his mind for some words that might console her, and would find only lame and useless ones. Yes, yes, that would happen very soon. The air of the room chilled his shoulders. He stretched himself cautiously along under the sheets and lay down beside his wife. One by one they were all becoming shades. Better pass boldly into that other world, in the full glory of some passion, and fade and wither dismally with age. He thought of how she who lay beside him had locked in her heart for so many years that image of her lover's eyes when he had told her that he did not wish to live. Generous tears filled Gabriel's eyes. He had never felt like that himself towards any woman, but he knew that such a feeling must be love. The tears gathered more thickly in his eyes, and in the partial darkness he imagined he saw the form of a young man standing under a dripping tree. Other forms were near. His soul had approached that region where dwell the vast hosts of the dead. He was conscious of, but could not apprehend, their wayward and flickering existence. His own identity was fading out into a grey, impalpable world. The solid world itself which these dead had one time reared and lived in was dissolving and dwindling. A few light taps upon the pane made him turn to the window. It had begun to snow again. He watched sleepily the flakes
silver and dark, falling obliquely against the lamplight. The time had come for him to set out on his journey westward. Yes, the newspapers were right. Snow was general all over Ireland. It was falling on every part of the dark central plain, on the treeless hills, falling softly upon the bog of Allen, and further westward, softly falling into the dark, mutinous Shannon waves. It was falling, too, upon every part of the lonely churchyard, on the hill where Michael Fury lay buried. It lay thickly drifted on the crooked crosses and headstones, on the spears of the little gate, on the barren thorns. His soul swooned slowly as he heard the snow falling faintly through the universe, and faintly falling like the descent of their last end upon all the living and the dead.
We hope you've enjoyed this Penguin audio production of Dubliners by James Joyce, read by Andrew Scott. It was produced by Matt Brown, and the post-production was by Elliot Smith. For more Penguin audio productions, visit us at penguin.co.uk/audio. Thanks for listening. Copyright in recording, Penguin Audio 2019. First published in 1914. Published in Penguin Books in 1956. Introduction copyright, Terence Brown, 1992. All rights reserved. The moral rights of the author have been asserted.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.